The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome to another episode of Kotaku Split Screen. It is February 25th, 2016, and I, Jason Schreier, your friendly host, am back for another episode. I'm here with Kirk Hamilton. Hi, Kirk.
Hey, Jason. How's it going? You don't sound like Steven. You sound like Jason.
is that supposed to be a compliment or what? I don't, what are you trying to go with there?
I think it's a compliment. Let's say there's a compliment. I could have started this off Steven style and made some joke about how this isn't some other podcast that we aren't, because apparently that's his running entrance joke. This isn't Serial. I thought this was going to be Serial.
It's really funny, those jokes. They just make me laugh every time. I was listening to, so you guys did an episode without me last week, and I was listening to it. It was very good. You guys did a fine job.
Cool. Glad you enjoyed that.
I was impressed. I especially enjoyed Steven trying to be mean to you to make up for me not being there.
Mm-hmm. Just to carry over the energy of the show, which is Kirk is pretty chill and nice, and Jason's kind of a dick to him sometimes.
I mean, it's not just the show. It's like real life.
Right, right. This is just how it works. I mean, this is people, if you like Jason Schreier and you want to be friends with him, part of the deal is he's going to kind of be a dick to you sometimes. This is how it goes.
Just keeping it real, man.
We love him anyways.
Just keeping it real. Man, so you and I haven't played video games together in a long time, huh?
Yeah, I know. I think about that a lot. I think we've talked about this on the podcast, but how there's, you know, when we were playing Destiny, it's like one of the funny side benefits of playing a lot of games online is that we just hang out a lot and like just talk about bullshit about our lives and food and movies and whatever else. And we still do that, you know, working together, but it is very different. And yeah, man, I miss it. You've been trying to get me to play Final Fantasy 14. I don't know.
You really should.
Literally, I mean, the reason I want to play it is because I want to just
hang out.
So we can just talk shit and like have fun online. That's the reason I want to play. I'm not really that excited about the game.
It's actually the way I've been playing it. It feels more like a single-player RPG than an MMORPG. Like, it feels like I'm going through this quest by myself to be a hero of light. And there's a whole story, and like there was this whole emotional scene that I ran into where people did some things, and I didn't expect some things to happen. I want to be vague because I don't want to ruin it for people. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Final Fantasy 14. It's such a fascinating story behind that game too, the way that it launched in 2010. Square released this whole big thing. I mean, really, it's the whole interesting story started when they announced it, because they announced it before Final Fantasy 13 had even come out.
Right, I remember that.
Everyone was like, oh, an MMO? Like, who wants another Square MMO?
Mm-hmm.
And then, because they just released 11, and it felt like 11 was still this ongoing thing. Even today, 11 is still getting new patches and updates and stuff. So back then, it was kind of received, there was a tepid response, let's say.
You mean to the announcement? There was a tepid response.
To the announcement. Then it came out in 2010, and it was unanimously declared shitty. Like, nobody liked it.
Mm-hmm.
After a point, even Square was like, okay, this is a bad game. We were too ambitious graphically, and we need to do some things. So they took it down for a while, and then they came back with A Realm Reborn in, what was it, 2012? Something like that. 2011, 2012?
That sounds about right. 12 actually seems a little, like, it seems like it was more recent than that.
The really?
Realm, I think so, but maybe not. I could be wrong. I guess we
could be.
Just
it could
up.
Be 2013. I'm not 100% sure. But, and then suddenly everyone was like, oh, wow, like, they made a great game. Somehow in this period of like a year and a half, 2 years, they turned it from this disaster into a legitimately great MMO with like a really good story and killer music and whatnot. Anyway, it's only gotten better since then with the new expansion, and I've been binge playing for a while, for the best few weeks.
So I looked it up just for information's sake. It was August 24th, 2013. That's what the internet tells me.
Yeah, that is pretty recently, huh?
Yeah, I remember picking it up. I mean, and it was when, I guess, Yeah, it was probably in 2014, maybe, that we first started talking about playing it and first tried it out. Does that sound right? Or was it
No,
15?
It was last year, because it was during a Destiny lull.
It was, and we got some of our Destiny people, Patrick and Kevin, to play.
Oh, I remember. It was after Dark Below came out, and then it was during that, like, 2 to 3 month break period when we stopped playing because House
right,
of Wolves
Right. So early 2015, I guess, was kind of when we first tried it.
Yeah. Speaking of Destiny, we still haven't talked about the announcements that they made a couple weeks ago, because I missed it, because we recorded before they did all that.
Right.
Before they were like, Destiny 2.
Well, it's funny because we recorded kind of, like we were talking about this, we kind of already recorded a reaction to the things that they announced almost.
Right, because I had
recorded
them.
Knew them beforehand, so it kind of made it a little redundant to then talk about, but they did make all that stuff official, so.
That's true.
Yeah, what all so is just, official? What's official now? I lose track of what's official and what is just things that we know.
Well, the things I know have all been
confirmed.
Made. Yeah, confirmed. Well, so I didn't know that they were going to do an expansion. Okay, so what I heard
let's walk,
and
let's walk
in
listeners
January,
through yeah. what. Yeah, what what's
we'll
what.
We'll walk this back. Okay, so to those of you who haven't been following the story of Destiny, and we'll get back to Final Fantasy XIV
right,
in a
right,
second.
Right.
We're
we can thread. We can just
bit.
Thread. We can multitask. We can thread these games right. through one another in a right. grand tapestry of podcasting.
This is people always ask what it's like to work at Kotaku. This is what it's like. We just juggling things back and forth, trying to figure out what's
yeah.
going on.
Constantly
okay,
just
so,
changing your mind, changing the subject, getting distracted. Yeah, that's
doing
much
four
it.
Stories at once. Mm-hmm. So yeah. So Destiny. So okay. So after Taken King came out in September, there's been like this. Feeling of malaise in the Destiny community because there's no new content and nobody knew for a while what was coming next. Bungie had been super quiet about it. So in January, I wrote this piece about the Destiny malaise, and we also recorded an episode that was dedicated pretty much solely to that, mm-hmm. In which I talked about how one of the reasons Bungie hasn't given people a roadmap is that everything's in flux. And at the time, I heard that in early January, they decided to delay Destiny 2 out of this September and into next year. I'm not sure when next year they're going to wind up releasing it. I think it'll be next fall, but don't hold me to that. I'm not 100% sure. And then I had also heard they were tasking the live team with making new DLC, but it was all kind of in flux. And I wrote that piece. And immediately a bunch of Destiny YouTubers and podcasters decided to shit on us because of our anonymous sourcing. And just shout out to them. Shout out to all
those
people.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for listening and reading Kotaku. We really appreciate it.
It was fun. I went back to a couple of things after they had confirmed it, because Bungie later confirmed it, or Activision confirmed it, really, in an earnings call 2 weeks ago, so in early February. And they said there's going to be an expansion this fall and then Destiny 2 next year. And so I went back and I listened to a couple of those podcasts and watched a couple of YouTube videos, and some of these people who are like Destiny community figures, I guess, and some reporters from major gaming websites also are like, what is Kotaku new? Or is Kotaku making this up? Why won't they name their sources? I don't really trust
it. I like
it.
That. I have to say, just as an interjection, that I really like that complaint of why don't they name their sources, which is like so just... You know, this is the most basic shit of entertainment reporting is that you hear from, I mean, I don't know, whatever. We don't have to go down a whole thing on it. It just made me laugh a lot. That it's like, if they were real sources, you'd name them. It's like, well, if they were real sources you never wanted to use again and you wanted to burn, maybe, but,
Yeah, it's funny because, like, using, I mean, rule number, the, like, basic 101 of reporting is that using an anonymous source is never ideal.
Right.
But sometimes when you're reporting on sensitive things that companies don't want you to know yet, you have to use anonymous sources and you have to protect them. And then as a reader, your amount of trust in anonymous sources is based on the reporter in question.
Right. Like, the reporter has theoretically confirmed who these people are. You've confirmed who your sources are. You're not just getting an email from some random Gmail address and trusting it. Like, that's... I think that actually people, maybe at least in games, don't always understand that, because it is something that you see so constantly at, like, Deadline or at, you know, other, like, major entertainment outlets. People constantly report based on their sources. That's just how it works. I guess maybe because people people don't see it as much in games. There's this misunderstanding, but that made me laugh. That
well,
that
to
would
be fair,
be
okay. Well, so to be fair, I think one of the reasons games people are more skeptical is because some gaming sites actually do just take random anonymous emails that True. Come to them and use them as sources. And it's like, what was the thing? It was that VG247 thing where they did that report about Bungie selling heavy ammo. That mm-hmm. was the type of thing that read to me like they had just gotten an email from an anonymous source who had maybe predicted things before, but they didn't actually know who that source was. Mm. And it's similar to the thing that I tweeted a thing also about VG247 because they had done that sort of thing before with Dishonored 2, where they ran this big fake fact sheet that appeared in their inbox, and that was from an anonymous source, presumably, where they didn't know who that person was and couldn't prove that they were connected to the companies
in
question.
Well, and like all of that kind of stuff can be pretty easily handled by just being pretty clear about what you know and what you don't know. Like there's a way to say, you know, I've confirmed that this source would have a reason to have this knowledge.
Yeah, but
or
if you're
to just
a reader,
say like, I mean, if you do run a random thing that gets emailed to you, you can say, hey, I got emailed this random ass thing. Isn't this interesting? And just put it on your site. Like that's not responsible. I wouldn't do that. But if you're clear about it, at least like, it hopefully would draw the line between an actual anonymous source that you've confirmed and vetted and just, you know, a random ass email that you got.
But to an average reader, I don't think they're necessarily going to read that closely into it. They might not be reading everything carefully.
Of course.
Have the requisite knowledge. So if I'm an average gamer and I see sites like Kotaku running an anonymous source story and then a site like VG247 running that heavy ammo thing or like some of the other stuff they've run that turned out to be incorrect, I don't know what the difference is. And so I think a lot of it is just like and so I sympathize when people
right.
are skeptical.
Right. Well, and in fairness to everybody, also Kotaku has done that before too. Like not you, but it's happened.
Right, where we've been
Kotaku
where we've
has been totally dead
things.
Wrong on things and we've run mm-hmm. shit that's been messed up like I can also understand people being skeptical because they say, well, I don't know. I remember Kotaku being wrong about something or other and not, you know, having all the knowledge of like who wrote what and when it happened and what the source was
right.
and all of that.
Right. 100%. But yeah, so I appreciated we got a lot of nice emails and notes and feedback and whatnot from people who were like, oh, like Vindication, you guys were totally right, yada, yada. And I appreciate that. I appreciated that people came to us and were like, wait a minute, Kotaku gets everything right about Destiny. Mm-hmm. They reported on all of the Taken King and the details in that before it was announced. They reported on that giant story in October about Destiny. And they've run like Kirk Hamilton's smartest reviews and criticism.
I like
Destiny.
That you managed to work me in there just a little bit. I appreciate
you
that. I appreciate it. They said Kotaku was right, says Jason Schreier, who basically wrote all of the articles in question.
Well, hey, I mean, you help out often.
It's true.
You
it's
help
true.
edit my stories into mm-hmm. Into much better shape than they were when I handed them to you.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, with that Destiny Malaise story, one of the other pieces of criticism I saw from certain people on the internet is that like if this is your big piece of news, Destiny 2 is delayed, why didn't you make that the headline? Why did you couch it in this whole bit in this other thing where it's like buried in the fourth paragraph? And like, I don't know. I feel like if you're reading that and that's your takeaway, then you're not really getting it because the point of that story was to make a much broader point about Destiny and Bungie and why they haven't given us a roadmap and why they've been so silent about things and the fact that things are in flux and they're dealing with all these tight deadlines and awful restrictions from Activision, et cetera, and their tools, obviously. They're terrible tools that they have to work with. So I don't think that I don't know. I can't envision us running a story with a headline like Destiny 2 delayed when Destiny 2 hasn't been announced
yet. Yeah, that was the funny thing about this story in particular was that, right, this isn't like Uncharted 4 is delayed.
Right.
Like, it wasn't a thing that had been even announced. So it was just weird on, you know, just on that level of, well, this is a story that we've got and we knew that was happening and now we know it's changed. So this is interesting, but like as news, it's a little weird just because...
Right. Yeah. Well, which is why it was couched within this bigger piece about mm-hmm. a lot of other things
right.
for us. And then other sites, of course, took like just read that and ran stories with the headline, Destiny 2 delayed. But, I mean, there's nothing I can do about what other sites do with the information that I give people.
Other than complain on podcasts.
Other than complain on split screen. And then the other, that was funny. The other thing that I saw, even after Activision confirmed what we reported, that it was that Destiny 2 is coming in 2017, people were like, oh, it's not technically a delay because they never announced
it. Right.
Which is also silly because internally they had that target and then they delayed it.
Yeah, and it's just, I mean, it's part of the weird, like, scorekeeping that was going on, I think, relating to that story in general. Like, well, he was right, but I mean, technically, it's, you're like, all right, whatever. Like, just, if you were a dick about that story, like, just maybe just say, oh, yeah, you know what, I was a dick about it, and, like, he was right, and move on.
Yeah, but anyway, but we'll move on to, and we'll keep trying to do our best to do awesome work on Destiny and everything else that we report.
Yeah, the question, so if we can talk about Destiny for a second here. So they announced that there's an expansion coming later this year, some kind of expansion, and that the next proper game is coming next year.
Yeah.
What do you think that means? Like, what do you picture that being?
Well, so I think the proper game is still going to be the same executable file on your PS4 or Xbox or whatever.
Right. I mean more like what the scope, the size, like what do you think the thing coming this year is even going to be?
I think it's going to be massively disappointing because I don't think that they have anything that they can make. I think they're going to be crunching hardcore over the next few months to try to come up with something. I guess it's possible that they pull stuff from Destiny 2, but I think they were having enough trouble trying to figure out how to put enough stuff in Destiny 2 to make it worth $60. So, yeah, I think this fall's thing is don't get your hopes up if you're a Destiny fan.
Yeah, I mean, I really think about that because no matter what comes out this fall, like we get the sense that there's this kind of constant give and take going on at Bungie about what goes into the full sequel and what goes into expansions. Because there just isn't enough stuff and everything takes forever. But even if it is like, say it's like House of Wolves style, like it's pretty cool. There's some cool missions. There's like two new strikes or something, maybe even a new raid. And that comes out. Even then, the sequel isn't going to come out until, let's say maybe fall of 2017. Like what it's making me think is that my time as a really dedicated Destiny player is kind of over, maybe. Like, I'm really having a hard time imagining coming back to, and this is, I should say, I played The Taken King like an insane amount, so I'm talking about playing that much, like, 100 hours, 200 hours in a month. But I'm actually having a hard time now looking at that roadmap and not just seeing these gigantic gaps in between anything interesting coming out and just thinking maybe I'm not really gonna play this game the same way as I have. I think that maybe it's just going to run out of momentum or something.
It's possible. I don't know. I don't know what's going to be in the April update or spring update, whatever they said. Maybe there will be a new raid that will keep us occupied for months to come. I honestly have no idea. But this fall's thing, the interesting thing is I think they want to sell it as if it's a Taken King-style expansion, presumably for $40 with a big E3 reveal and everything like that. But the difference between this and the Taken King is that development on The Taken King started before the original Destiny even shipped. So it had at least a year and a half, I think, longer in development because it kept getting rescoped. And the Dreadnought, the main part of The Taken King, was developed for the original Destiny and then pushed back into Taken King.
Well, right. So, and, I mean, if you look at all the different ways that The Taken King remixes things from vanilla Destiny, it's like not only were they using new stuff, like quote new, unquote stuff that was actually stuff they'd been making since the first game. Also, so like they're running out of levels that they can make us run through backwards, you know? Like it's like so much of the stuff still is
from the
original game. It starts to just be like, okay, well now what are we gonna run through the Dreadnought backwards, like in the next expansion? And
oh man.
There's gonna be grass everywhere and it's gonna be all green or like what, like how, I mean, I guess there are always more creative options, but it does make me wonder, like, okay, at some point you guys just have to put more real new stuff in the game and
It's difficult because of their content tools, because their pipeline is so difficult to work with, and because development on this fall's expansion, as far as I know, started when the Destiny 2 delay happened. Because before that they were planning on releasing the sequel this fall. And even when the delay actually happened, some people at Bungie were still under the impression that Destiny 2 is shipping this fall. So, yeah, I mean, it's looking dismal. I don't want to – it would be unfair for us to be like, oh, my God, everything's going to be shitty. Destiny is going to fall apart.
Well, it's still that funny thing of, like, it looking dismal or, like, looking shitty. But also, like, there's still this – this game, like, we have this game on our list of the best games for PS4 and Xbox One, and we were talking about this earlier, where it's really easy to fall into this sort of notion that, Destiny is disappointing now, and there's not enough in it, and everyone's out of things to do, but it's still, like, hundreds of hours of cool shit in the base game. It really, sometimes I do reflect on how there's this no-win situation for Bungie, just right. Because no matter what they put out, even if they, there's no way, you said if they put out a raid that we'll be playing for months to come, like, I just don't think there's any way, like, because everything they put out, people just devour it in, like, 2 weeks.
They've set up these expectations with year one, where it was new stuff every 3 months, and then a big expansion, and...
Yeah. I mean, they've also just made a really good game that people want to play a lot. Right, and, like, it's just like people just are starving to play and want to just play everything. So no matter what they put out, everyone will devour it. It really, unless there's some fundamental change that makes it, like, you know, way more randomized in Diablo, which I think we talked about on an earlier podcast. That's the kind of thing that starts to feel like, okay, maybe this gets sustainable. But past that, I don't know. It's hard to imagine.
I guess we'll see if the Division can replace it. Which we'll talk about when The Division comes out in a couple weeks.
Worryingly soon, but
One more quick thing about Destiny, and then I want to go back to Final Fantasy. Mm-hmm. So Destiny, I saw an article the other day, I don't remember where it was, but it was saying, why doesn't Destiny add more microtransactions and then they'll be able to afford to add more content, which I think is kind of a naive, almost ignorant way of looking at things, in that more money does not equate to more content with mm-hmm. a company like Bungie. And people are always like, oh, they had $500 million.
Right.
Why is everything so slow? But think about what money actually means in game development. Money means more people. Or it can mean more equipment or whatever. But usually money means more people, a bigger team. Right now, Bungie is 500, 600 people. They also have High Moon Studios working with them on Destiny 2. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of people. More people would not help the problem, because more people would not help mitigate the issue of their tools not being that good. Because mm-hmm. when you're a designer and you come into the office and you're using this brand new engine that was created just for Destiny, and you want to move stuff around on a map or try to create new things, and it takes you hours upon hours of unnecessary time because of all these pipeline issues that you're dealing with this engine, more people, more designers is not going to help solve that problem.
Right. When you've got, like, a clog in your workflow, you can't, like, the clog needs to be addressed. It doesn't matter how many people you put outside of the clog is still going to be there. And it's still
if Kotaku, if Kinja, blessed be, if Kinja had to type in a word into Kinja and then wait 10 minutes before you could type in the next word,
you had to load your Kotaku, post overnight.
And Kotaku is suddenly only posting, like, once every week, hiring more people, throwing more money at the problem would not solve it, because we would need to fix the tools. And so, I believe that Bungie is working on fixing those pipeline problems.
Well, I mean, and you can hire people to fix that, right? Like, if that happened with Kinja, we would just hire more engineers and task them with fixing Kinja rather than writers.
That would take a lot of time, and there's the issue of, like, should they be working on fixing that? Should they be working on a new form of Kinja? There are a lot of questions there.
I like that this is now a discussion of Kinja. It's the painting a moving train thing, right? It's that they're in development, the game is out, they have a live team, and now, okay, great, we're really going to overhaul our tools. And I mean, long term, that's probably the answer, because
for Destiny,
it sounds
2.
Like a nightmare. But I can imagine that being their challenge.
Anyway, now that we've gotten the Destiny out of the way.
There's like a reader question about Destiny. I'm sure there will be more Destiny on this podcast. I don't want to make promises that we can't keep here.
Final Fantasy 14. So you played a little bit of it, right?
We played together a bit. I played a fair bit.
We did a dungeon together.
Yeah. I played probably 10, 15 hours or something like that.
Yeah, I think it's really cool. I love playing it on my PS4, even though when I'm playing with another party, it's so funny because I get in there and I want to type something, but I don't have an external keyboard, so I have to do it on my controller.
Oh, God.
So I have to stop doing everything.
Typing like terrible short sentences full of typos.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's so much fun. So I'm playing as a tank, and when you do dungeons, you did a dungeon, right? So the way it works is you're doing all these quests MMO style. You go kill things and find things and explore this giant world. It's really cool. It's really pretty. The music's really cool. The story's really cool. It's really well written. A lot of actual humor. Mm-hmm. It doesn't take itself seriously, which is like the one thing that Final Fantasy should go back to having a sense of humor. So as you're playing through the main quest, there are you unlock dungeons gradually. And to do a dungeon, you need a party of four. And there's matchmaking, so you can do a party of four random people. So I've been doing this as I've been playing. The story takes you through all these random dungeons, and I've been doing them. And so I get into a dungeon, and I'm the tank, so I'm expected to be the leader. The tank is the guy who pulls all the mobs and like leads progress through the dungeon. So I'll be going, and sometimes people will yell at me because I don't know what I'm doing because it's like my first time playing a dungeon or trying to take on a boss. Uh-huh. And so in order to respond to them, since I don't have a keyboard, I have to use my PS4.
Meanwhile, your guy is just standing there failing even harder than they were yelling at you for already failing. You're like trying
just
to type
wiping the party. Yeah. Oh my God. It's so embarrassing. I would be so pissed off if I was playing with me.
That's pretty funny.
So I think I need to buy a keyboard if I'm going to do some serious like raining.
You could also do the thing. Isn't there a way on PS4 you can like sync your phone up so that you can use your phone as a keyboard?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, you can use the PlayStation app, I think, on your phone. I'm picturing the way that now that I've been to your place and I know the like Jason Schreier station where you're like kicked back on your couch and you've got your laptop and your phone and all your screens, that I could kind of picture you just typing on your phone really quick if you use that app. And I think that works. It doubles as the keyboard. So that could
Do you want to tell all our split screen listeners about how tiny my Manhattan apartment is?
I thought it was for a Manhattan apartment. It was perfectly fine.
It's not too bad. Nah. For two people, it's a little cramped.
Yeah, a little tight for two. But
used to live there by myself. My girlfriend only moved in a year and a half ago, and then I lived there by myself for like 3 years before that.
The nice thing is, you know, if you can cohabit with your girlfriend in a space that small, that's like pro mode cohabitation practice for when you get a bigger place, and then you'll be like, oh my gosh, we have so much room, we never even see each other anymore. This is very different.
That is true. But anyway, so Final Fantasy XIV, it's really great. I really am enjoying it. Oftentimes when I'm playing, I'll do other stuff in that I'll like be watching something on my computer. Like I was watching the whole Double Fine documentary while playing Final Fantasy XIV, or like listening to podcasts. It's a really good game to play while you're doing other stuff. And I don't mean that as an insult because it's still so much fun. It's just like when you're doing the whole MMO combat thing, you probably want to be doing something
else. Yeah, you're
kind
of auto-attacking and just sort of watching the numbers.
Autopilot-y. Yeah, but I'm really digging it. And I think it's only going to get better. If you're into Final Fantasy, I recommend it.
One thing I really like before we move off Final Fantasy XIV is that I can play with you on PC. I really wish more games did that because I have it on PC and it looks, you know, it just runs a little better. It looks a little better on PC, and I generally prefer to play everything on PC. And I really like that I can just get on and you're playing on PS4 and I'm on PC and we could just team up and play. I wish more games did that. I guess I understand why it's not common, but I did really like that about it.
Are there any games, other than the obvious ones, like Arkham Knight, are there games that are better on on consoles than they are on PC?
That's
just because it's more fun to play them with a PS4 controller or like...
No, not really. I can't really think of any just because I use a PS4 controller on PC and...
Oh, right. You know, I thought you couldn't. I thought you had to use an Xbox controller.
No, you have. Yeah, I've written a whole thing about it. You have to use this sort of wrapper software, but it's really easy to do and it works great. So I can use it. And then actually some games, more and more games now, you can just leave it plugged in and it'll detect that you have a DualShock and it'll... put like PS4 button prompts. So you have to kind of use Xbox button prompts a lot of the time, and like, which can be confusing because you know how the X is in a different place. The Xbox X is the square button on a PS4 controller, and the A button on an Xbox is the X button on a PS4. Yeah. So you'll see and it's blue. They're both blue. So you'll see this blue X and just be like, oh, fuck, wait, which version is this? And you kind of just press both buttons and you, like, hope it works.
That's like in the old days on the PS1 with Japanese games in Japan.
Right,
the zero,
right.
It was always the X. And then here, the X is always the zero.
Yeah, they're always flipped.
Some games, but in some games, they wouldn't flip.
Yep.
So like in some, you'd always have to test it out when you first picked it up and be like, is X confirm or is
it was the confirm backwards thing, and I'm trying to remember now because it was when I played FF7. I think it was that the buttons were switched but the prompts weren't, so circle was go forward and X was go back, and it drove me crazy. It was like actually really interesting how conditioned I'd been to like, okay, the bottom button on the D-pad like goes forward and the right side button goes back, and that's just how it works, and like having to switch was like profoundly difficult for me to do.
So speaking of PC games, I've been playing a couple of PC games.
Yeah, me too.
Real quick, I revisited Pillars of Eternity for the expansion.
Yeah, so
great game.
Tell me, man. Should I have both of the expansions. I played a lot. I mean, you know, enough to be like, okay, I like this. It's one of those games that I feel a lot of regret, I guess, about not playing because it's so totally my kind of game, and I think I'd really like it.
Yeah, I don't know why you haven't.
I just haven't made time,
it.
I think. But how are the expansions? Should I go and just play all of it? Like, do
yeah? What
do
I would everything? Do actually, if I were you, and what I like to do with all those big RPGs is just like pick a weekend, start a new character, so mm-hmm. you like can don't have to go in the middle and remember
yeah,
everything
I really
you played.
Would need to do that. Yeah,
and just like marathon it for hours and hours and hours. That's huh. the best way to play it. But yeah, I haven't played a ton of the expansions, but they're really cool from what I've seen so far.
Mm-hmm.
Underrated game of last year. I mean, I guess it was properly rated, but not talked about enough.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure they'll release a sequel because it did really well for them.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other game I've been playing, and I don't know if I can really talk that much about it, is Day of the Tentacle, which we just got codes for. Man, that game has aged well. It's really cool. I can't wait. You know what? Well, we should hold off on that because that's coming out next month. You and I are going to talk about it more.
Yes.
We may have a special guest to talk about
it. We might.
We have a couple of really good guests coming next month. So look forward to it, Split Screen listeners.
Get excited. Yeah, we can talk about that later. I played a little bit of Day of the Tentacle, too.
Okay, cool. Let's save that for another time.
Yeah.
And then the other thing we had to talk about is, of course, Fire Emblem.
Yes, another big game that we're both playing.
How much have you played?
I don't know. I played like 6 or 7... maybe 8 chapters, and
okay,
then...
so you made the big decision.
Oh, yeah. I didn't... So I don't have the collector's edition. I just bought Birthright, because... So there is no decision. When you buy Birthright, it just goes straight into the, like... Hoshido, is that what they're called? Into the Hoshido storyline.
Hoshido.
So there isn't, like, a choice. I think it just goes straight into it.
Gotcha.
Which was fine by me. I've read... It was very clear immediately from Patricia's coverage and talking about, you know, which game to play, whether to play Conquest or Birthright, that Birthright was going to be the way to go. Should we explain the difference to listeners if they don't know the difference?
Sure. Well, I mean, Fire Emblem, I think there are a lot of people who are interested in Fire Emblem but didn't even play Awakening
yeah.
a couple of years ago. So Fire Emblem is this big strategy RPG series that's been around for a long time,
mm-hmm.
And it just picked up this new wave of popularity with Fire Emblem Awakening on 3DS a couple of years ago. That game was great. It's like, so the way it works is you have characters on a big grid, and you have an army on one side and enemies that you have to fight. And you kind of attack an enemy on the grid, Shining Force style. That's the best reference I have for it, because Shining Force is a game that was almost identical to Fire Emblem back in the day.
Mm. But
basically, you move and you attack, and it's a tactical RPG. You can't let your characters die, because if you're playing on classic mode, they will permanently die.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other big thing, other than the combat, which is great, is the whole relationship building system.
Right, which I gather was kind of a new thing for Awakening, at least in how far that game took it with, like,
yeah.
love and marriage and kids and, like,
yeah.
and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first Fire Emblem that I really played, was Awakening. And I think people loved that part of it, you know. There's kind of the two fans of the series, right? Like, there's people who like, it's a really good tactical RPG, but then there's also just people who are into all the anime romance, you know, like, you're basically shipping your characters in a strategy RPG, and then they get married and become more powerful, which is really an awesome idea.
Which is so stupid.
Yeah, but kind of great. Generally great.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm definitely the former type of player, the strategy type of player who doesn't care about the relationships.
Yeah,
at all.
I find that when I play the games, I'm more into the strategy, but when I talk about the games, I have a lot more fun just goofing off and riffing about who's the most dreamy and like who's.
But you also tend to fall in love with like anime girls in your RPGs.
I mean, in a joking way. I mean, Anna. I fell in love with Anna in Awakening. But how could you not fall in love with Anna in Awakening?
I don't even remember who
amazing.
Anna is.
She's the merchant. The merchant who you come across, and she has all the like twin merchants. I think she's in Fates as well. I saw that she was in there, and I can't believe.
Well,
you don't
there's
know
a
who
DLC
Anna is.
That lets you add all the Awakening characters.
Right. I think that she's actually in the game. I saw her in one of those crazy like character breakdown sheets that had all the characters on both sides. So the two sides thing confused me for so long until I finally played the game, like the two games thing, the Conquest and Birthright thing. And I think it. Do you think that Nintendo, like, fucked up in how they explained this to people? Because I didn't understand how it worked for so long. Like, until a week ago, I finally was like, okay. Like, when reviews started coming in, I finally got it.
Yeah, their messaging has been weird from the get-go, because even when they first announced that it was coming to the U.S., people were so confused because they wouldn't actually say whether it was two games or not.
Right.
And, like, I think I remember I have this vivid memory of finding something buried in a press release where they mentioned both versions of the game, and it's in tiny print. And, like, I tweeted that, and people looked at that and were like, oh, that's confirmed. It's two games. But we didn't know for sure until much later during Nintendo Direct when they were like, yeah, it's two different games. So the way it works is you are this kid, this male or female, who grows up in the country of Nor, which is kind of this evil country.
It's basically medieval dicks.
Yeah, run by this like Palpatine-looking king. You're exiled to a fortress and whatever. And then it turns out you learn, this isn't really a spoiler because it's really early on, you learn that you were actually born in another country and then brought to Nor. You were born in this country, Hoshido, and then brought to Nor. So the way it splits up is at chapter 6, if you picked Birthright, the game Birthright, which is $40, I think they're both $40, mm-hmm. You side with Hoshido. And if you pick Conquest, then you side with Nor, the evil folks.
Right.
And the story is like Nor is just like invading Hoshido for the sake of being dicks.
They're just jerks. And like Hoshido are just good guys, right?
Yeah.
They're just kind
of, I mean,
like, yay, we're nice, we're good guys. I think that was Patricia's complaint anyways about that campaign, is that they're sort of boring good guys.
They're kind of smarmy, yeah. And then Revelation, which is the third game, which you can buy as DLC for $20. I think it starts selling on March 10th. But if you bought the special edition, I think it comes with it. That lets you choose neither side. And then that leads you to like the true ending.
So
I haven't gotten that.
So, and then also you can buy – like I can buy – I bought Birthright, but I can buy Conquest, I believe, for $20 as well. Like I don't think you have to pay. You don't have to pay $40 for both.
Right. So it's $80 for the whole package
with
all three games.
Right. So what I'm really interested. First off, I think that setup is super fucking interesting. Like I think that it's really ambitious, and like the idea that you play through this game and you fall in love with people and like get married and watch them have kids and watch them whole lives, and then you play through it again as the other side and kill them all, and like that's so good. And then that there's this third option that I don't know about, where you get all the people that you fell in love with and like on both sides to work together, I'm assuming, to fight off whatever. Great. Like I really think that's amazing. It's an intimidating amount of video game, but it's a cool idea.
The way you say fall in love with makes me wonder about you, Kirk. Are you feeling lonely over there?
No. I don't need friends. I'm not just sitting alone in a room talking to my 3DS every night and having it keep me company. Nothing like that. It's not sad. It's not sad if it's anime. Anime can't be sad.
anime is real, man.
Anime is real. Anyway, I think that idea is really cool, and I was sort of surprised, I guess because it's expensive and because it's caught up in buying the game, that they didn't explain that more clearly, because that idea is kind of amazing when you lay it all out and look at what it really is. It's a crazy amount of game. I mean, I think it's like hundreds of hours. I mean, Awakening was really long too, but just the idea of how long this thing is.
They didn't have a chance to explain the division clearly, because they were too busy worried about petting and how they would explain removing the petting.
You said the division, and I thought you were talking about Tom Clancy's The Division.
No, I would have said Tom Clancy's The Division.
Right, you have to get the full name.
You know that we always refer to it as Tom Clancy's The Division.
Of course, it's very important to get the author's name in there.
When Watch Dogs 2 is announced, we're going to have to refer to it as Watch_Dogs 2.
Right. Hopefully, maybe there will be an underscore before the 2 as well. Or an watch_dogs2: the watchening.
What was the name of that game? HTR.
Oh, God, with a semicolon. No, wait, was that the one with a semicolon, or that was a different one?
No,
it was
Steins
just letters. Yeah,
just
a bunch of letters.
But, yeah, I mean, so Fire Emblem Fates. So do you like it? Are you enjoying playing through it?
Yeah, you know, I thought that I wouldn't.
What difficulty are you on?
So, well, I'll get there in a second. I started it on normal classic, because that was how I played Awakening. So that's a normal difficulty, not too hard, but with permadeath. I started it, yeah, and I was actually thinking, I've been playing a ton of XCOM 2, which is like another tactical strategy game with permadeath and where you get attached to troops and it's stressful and it's the whole thing. And I was kind of thinking, I'm not going to have the bandwidth for this game, but I started playing it and almost immediately found myself getting pulled in. There's something about Fire Emblem's rhythm, the rhythm of gameplay and the way the whole thing works, like where it zooms out and in so quickly and it just is so pleasing to play and to watch the, like, you know, enemy turn, your turn, the way the music changes, the way the music gets loud and it pulls in and it zooms out. And it's just this constant bouncing thing that just immediately had me being like, yay, I'm so glad I'm playing this game again. And I wasn't actually expecting that. So I'm definitely going to play more. I restarted.
One thing, by the way, to interrupt you, one thing that I think is more, makes it more pleasing in that way, in that Nintendo-y, like, super smooth, buttery way, is, I can't believe I just said buttery. I hate
you
that.
Did.
I hate it when people
you just did, though. You
refer
really
to
said
games
it.
As buttery.
You can't take it back. Buttery,
can we edit that
just
out?
Buttery smooth.
Edit out buttery.
I'll just
our
bleep
sensor.
You.
Can you, yeah, can you bleep that, please?
Okay, I'll bleep it.
So one thing that makes it feel a lot more smooth is to turn off combat animations and just make it so they attack one another on the screen without.
Well, so, but if you do that, do you not get the, because I love the music, though. Like, I love the way that the music goes from this zoomed out version to a much more intense, louder, fully orchestrated version when you zoom in for the battle cam. So I don't know. I think
I think you lose that. But I don't know. It just makes everything move so much faster, though.
Yeah.
I really appreciate that. But anyway, go ahead. Finish what you were saying about.
Oh, so I restarted just because I hadn't gotten to the world map yet, and I just wanted to play the beginning again. And I kind of think I'm actually going to play on casual. The game's hard. I was doing fine and kind of had to replay one of the missions a few times just because I kept losing people. And then I had a thing happen where a guy who was an ally, like I think the prince, basically. There's this battle early on where you like a thing happens and you're fighting and the prince is sort of down in this fight at the bottom of the screen. And he got beaten in his fight and is like, oh no, I'm defeated. And they said, oh, don't leave, you know, just go wait by the sidelines or something, which is what I think they always say to story characters who get killed in these games because they don't actually die. You just can't use them anymore. Is that right?
No, I think if he's a guest, you don't lose
them. Right. You told me that later, but either way, I was worried he died and I actually was supposed to be able to use
him. But also, wasn't he a Nor prince? So it doesn't even matter.
No, it was the dark haired, spiky haired dude who's like the Hoshido prince.
Oh yeah, no, you don't lose him. No.
Right, but I just wasn't sure, and then I just was realizing I'm just going to be paralyzed by this. And the way that I played Awakening was also if I screwed up and lost a character that I loved, which, you know, by the time I had a regular crew, I liked every character in my rotation. I would just go back and restart the battle anyways. Which isn't, like, it's not completely the same as playing on casual, but I just decided, look, I have 3 games to get through. I want to play them. I'm going to try it on casual for a little while. I might go back to classic if I don't like it. Nah,
lame.
I don't actually, I honestly don't think it's lame when there's this much of the game to check out. And I really want to play it. Like, I don't want
to
just play, like, 4 or 5 hours
and then
stop. No,
the way to play, man, the way to play is to play with permadeath on classic, but if someone dies, accept that and move on.
No, I mean,
that's
not
how I'm playing.
Well,
that's
okay, that's
playing.
The
it's
way
great.
You play. I mean, I think it's important. I think there was a comment thread under, I did a poll yesterday to ask people whether they use permadeath or not. On Conquest and on Birthright, it was sort of interesting results. On Conquest, fewer people are playing with permadeath because Conquest is much harder than Birthright. And on Birthright, it was more people playing with permadeath than without. But there was a thread under it, and the first guy said basically what you just said. He's like, well, it's not Fire Emblem without permadeath, and that's the only thing that makes this game fun and consequential. And then other people are saying, dude, you know, like, if it's fun for you, it's fun for you. I think the question for me right now is this actually going to be fun for me? I could see it not being fun. Like, I could see myself getting through 2 or 3 missions and feeling the absence of
easy.
That. I'll be interested. I mean, I'll try it and report back. Because if I do think it's just not that exciting, I'll totally go and start again and play on Classic again.
So, So I'm playing on Classic. I'm on Chapter 16 or something like that. I'm also on Birthright. And the thing that I'm finding annoying is that sometimes you'll be all the way towards the end of a map map, and then your main character will just get critical hit. And,
yeah, crits are an issue. And, like, the fact that there's no... that just death is immediate, that it, and right. it's just game over.
Well, and then when it's your main character, yeah, it's game over, which yeah. is a bummer. But I lost a couple characters, and you actually... it's like the first one where you... or not the first one. It's like Awakening, where you get so many characters that it doesn't really matter if you're losing characters, because you'll always find someone who can be a good replacement, and it makes you think more strategically and defensively, and I don't know. I like that a lot more. I think you'll find it kind of lame and boring if you play, unless you're playing only because you care about falling in love with your anime waifus.
Right.
In which case, I will say, carry on.
It's funny. Like I was just reading Jake Solomon interview over at Rock Paper Shotgun about XCOM, which is tangentially related, but related, is he was saying, you know,
he's a lot of people. He's the director of XCOM.
The designer, I think, lead designer. Maybe creative director, but one of the main people. And he was saying, I see a lot of people doing, this is how I play XCOM, so like me, Kirk, he was saying, I see a lot of people play XCOM where they get their perfect squad that they love, and they just run that squad through every mission, and they, you know, reload saves and figure out, they treat each mission like a puzzle, basically. They mm-hmm. try to figure out how to get everyone through alive, and he said, that's not actually how the game is designed. We have all these systems in place. This isn't his exact quote or anything, but basically they have systems in place where you can recruit replacements and train them up faster, and the whole thing is designed that you're supposed to be losing people, but people don't play it that way. And then Fire Emblem, I remember this from Awakening, where I played it the same way in Fire Emblem. I had my main squad, and they were a bunch of married couples that were unstoppable, and I would just team them all up, and they would go clean house. And then I had all these people just sitting around at the stable doing nothing. And that is kind of, you know, I guess that is kind of, I miss out on seeing those characters. It's still the way I like to play.
I think there's something psychologically rooted in gamers' heads where we are groomed in RPGs and strategy games and pretty much every game mm-hmm. to not accept permanent consequences, because in a Final Fantasy game, when someone dies, you can just revive them. In most games, when there's no way to lose something permanently, because the games are all about building you up and making you feel more and more powerful as the game goes on, and making you get stuff rather than lose things. So when we play a game like XCOM or Fire Emblem, the natural instinct is, when you lose something, to just hit reset and go back and
definitely.
Not feel like you lost something.
I definitely think that's true. I mean, this is making me think of Eris in Final Fantasy
right.
and
right.
Final Fantasy VII. Amazing Brian Taylor article. I think we both read that from Killscreen from a million years ago, from like the print days of Killscreen back in like the second issue. He did this huge research thing into all the people over all the years who had come up with ways to revive Eris, and how that kind of tied to this idea that it just didn't seem fair, and everyone was like, why did she's really dead forever? That's not how video games work. I want
exactly.
to be able to get her back in. So then people make mods where you make Tifa look like Eris or whatever and play that way. I think that feels right on to me.
Right. Well, so I think it's really a lot more interesting and poignant and fun to play a game where you actually feel lost, and mm-hmm. it feels like everything has consequences and it matters when someone dies. But yeah, I mean, to each his own. I'm not going to tell people to play or not play a game a certain way. Fire Emblem, I don't know. I think I would be pretty bored. I'm already getting kind of bored because the story really isn't doing anything for me.
Yeah, I think that Conquest might actually wind up being the more interesting game in a lot of respects, because the cast seems more interesting. Like, the characters just all seem like... I can already say more about them than the Birthright people, even though I'm playing on the Birthright side. They just seem like, oh yeah, spunky guy, like, nice sister girl. Like, it just, they don't seem that interesting, where the... you know, the Conquest people are all these, like, ridiculous goth, like, Lolitas and, like, magic users and, like, super knights and stuff. And it just, I feel like maybe they're the more interesting side in general.
So what you're saying is, you saw that lady with the giant
cleavage. Basically, I just
want to hang out with my
stepsister and her huge knockers.
Let's do some reader questions.
Okay.
Okay. So we have a few that we want to get through. Just a reminder, if you have a reader question that you would like to send to us, send it to splitscreen@kotaku.com. We may or may not read it on the show. If we like it, we will. If we don't like it, we won't. If we like it, we might not. If we don't like it, we might. I don't know. You never know. It's all a gamble.
And really, anything can happen at this point.
Really, anything can happen. Just like life. Everything is meaningless.
It's true.
So Marvin asks, I really enjoy your podcast, and it was nice to hear more from Steven in the latest episode as well. Anyway, do you believe that Destiny 2 will be released on PC? Yes, I do. What about you?
It wouldn't surprise me. It would be tough because it would make me want to play it on PC. I'd have a really hard time staying on PS4, especially if I'm assuming they do that. They let you transfer your character progress over like one time only, like they do in GTA Online. That'd be great if they did. And it seems like it'd be a whole bunch more people who'd play their games.
I think Destiny 2 is going to be a lot more technically proficient, and they're going to be able to do some things they weren't able to do because I think it'll ditch the last gen consoles.
That seems almost certain that it won't be on Xbox 360 and PS3.
Yeah, and the way I think it'll work is you load it up, you buy Destiny 2 on your PS4 or Xbox or whatever, and you load it up and it kind of replaces your Destiny file, and then you go into Destiny and it's still the same game essentially, but now it's this new thing. Mm-hmm. I don't think it'll be like a totally new executable file where you go in and you have a new character and a new guardian, et cetera, et cetera. I think it'll be a lot. It'll be kind of on top of the old one, much in the way the Taken King was. Mm-hmm. But that's just a guess. I don't know for sure. And yeah, so I think it's could be on PC.
They're probably working on PCs to make the game to begin with. Like the game already in some version runs on PC, so it's more about other considerations than technical ones. Just before we move to the next question, that if they release this game on PC, it's going to be pretty exciting when it comes to cheating and modding and that kind of stuff. We're going to see some really, because, you know, there just hasn't been that much of that in Destiny so far, and it's going to be a really wild scene because, you know, just based on how kind of crusty some parts of the online infrastructure of this game are, that there are some holes there. And I would imagine that's maybe one of the primary things they'd be worried about releasing it on PC.
Yeah, that's a compelling reason not to release it on PC.
Yeah.
And also, I wonder what the console manufacturers have said. Like, obviously, they have this really close relationship with Sony where they're giving them DLC exclusive and like all those PvP maps and strikes and stuff where Sony had them a year in advance before Xbox got them. And I wonder if part of these whole big corporate deals between Activision and Sony and Microsoft involved not releasing it on PC. But I don't know. I have no idea. Anyway, let's move on to the next question.
Cool.
So Kevin says, with the sort of imminent arrival of Dark Souls 3, I found myself watching hour upon hour of lore videos by Epic, Vadi Vidya, and the like. Again, have you ever played a game or series that fascinated you on that level where you tried to analyze it to the nth degree and had a driving need to feel like you really understood it? This is a good question.
Yeah, I like it. It's funny because one of the answers is Destiny, that I think we've talked about that, like the lore of that game is fascinating. I was getting that out of the way. I love those Vadi Vidya videos on Bloodborne and Dark Souls. That was the game for me more than Dark Souls. Uh-huh. I became really obsessed with Bloodborne because that was the first one that I played all the way through. I knew who all the characters were. And then going and reading those lore breakdowns and just what's going on really actually improved my experience of the game. When I'd go back and play it, I felt like I now knew more about where I was in a way that was really, really cool. So I like that. I like that those games leave space for that. I think that that's like the secret of those games, right? Is that they don't tell, like the item descriptions are where people learn. The whole identity of the primary antagonist is like told through some random ass shield that you maybe find somewhere. And that has this crucial piece of information that, oh, he never knew his father and like actually is part demon or something like that. Which always kind of is very cool to see, you know, pulled together by people. I don't know. What about you? Do you have any?
Yeah, it has to be. It has to be a game that leaves some stuff to the imagination, because otherwise, like, if stuff is overexplained, like I was thinking about Kingdom Hearts and how that's a game that people probably overanalyze, but I wouldn't be interested because it's just so like people monologuing at one another. So one game that I recently got really fascinated by and obsessed with and read tons of stuff about is Undertale. Funny enough,
yeah, actually, that's a good one
because they. in designing Undertale, Toby Fox left a lot of secrets and left a lot of things unsaid. So I found that really interesting. I don't know. I've obsessed over a lot of games over the years. I remember when I, back in the day, when I was really into like Baldur's Gate and Icewind Dale and all those PC RPGs, mm-hmm. I would just read all the stuff about Dungeons and Dragons, even though I didn't actually play Dungeons mm-hmm. and Dragons. Mm-hmm. I just was fascinated by it because of the video games. So yeah, I don't know. I feel like
that's funny.
It's definitely not unusual.
Yeah, and I think actually, like, when I played D&D, like, when I was into D&D, sort of in middle school and early high school, I was just as into just reading the books. Like, I would just read the Monster's Manual or the Dungeon Master's Guide. I was a DM, and I would write campaigns, and we would do them, but I read a lot more about the lore of the Dungeons & Dragons universe than I actually used it to, like, play the game and make the game. So that's actually mm-hmm. a sort of old version of that yeah. same thing.
Yeah. Okay, one more question from a reader. So Liam says, I was wondering, as a student who is just starting the whole college and life gambit, good luck on that, Liam. Have mm-hmm. fun. Mm-hmm. If your future is ahead of you, enjoy it. Enjoy college, because it goes by really quickly.
Anyway, you'll barely remember it in a few years.
That's true. I barely remember college.
Yeah.
Well, that may involve things we ingested
during
college.
Things that actually happened in college, true.
Things that affected our memories. So Liam says, I was wondering, as a student who's just starting this whole thing, if you have any advice for someone who really wants to get into journalism, things like the road you took to make it to where you are right now, the jobs you took that helped you develop your writing style, or even just general do's and don'ts in the industry. Liam, my advice to you is don't.
Just a general don't. It's not
yeah,
a not
the do's
a don't
and don'ts. Just don't do it. That was half kidding. I mean, don't expect any sort of stability. Expect to be constantly fearing and worrying about the future of your industry. But I don't know. I mean, I think that the advice that we would give now will be useless in 4 years when you are out of college, because things change so rapidly in media and journalism that there's no way to really predict. Like, I don't know, 4 years ago there would be no way to predict that the future of media would be Facebook. And now that it is Facebook and that's where everyone reads everything, who knows what will come and take over in another 4 years.
I mean, I think you can still give... There's like broad advice. Maybe
of
some of it is really
broad
obvious.
Yeah.
Like learn how to write.
you know, read things.
Right.
Read books.
Try to network with people. Go to things and actually talk to people in real life. You know, there's basic tips like that. But then, it's hard to give advice for how to. We get asked this a lot. I think just if you manage to write about games for a living, it's a pretty cool thing to do for a job, and people want to know how to do it. And the answer is never easy, because I don't know. Like, I tell people, go be a professional jazz musician for 7 years and, like, teach high school and then randomly start a gaming blog. And then, you know, like, one thing will lead to another and you'll wind up editing Kotaku. Like, that's not really, like, very practical advice, right? But the idea that you have to go any one route or that there's one best route is not true. Though, I think... I see people overstate the importance of, or the role of just having other skills and doing other things. Like, I think actually having a journalism degree and having taken classes in journalism is extremely helpful for becoming a journalist. Like, people always say, oh, well, I was a saxophonist and now I'm doing this. It's like, yeah, great. But I learned a lot, and I'm also very lucky to work with you and with Steven and with people who went to journalism school who can tell me just the kinds of things you learn in school, doing those exercises and like actually.
Well, I didn't go to journalism school.
Oh, you didn't? Oh, I think. But did you like take journalism classes?
Yeah, sort of. And I was on my newspaper in school and did some. I've been doing it for a while, but no, I went to Gallatin, the NYU School of Individualized Study, and I took.
Oh, that's right. That's right. We've talked about that. That's right. So you just learned journalism from other people, but
I did. And maybe if we're lucky, we'll have a college friend of mine on the podcast soon. That's a little foreshadowing there.
Yeah, that'll be exciting if and when that happens.
A certain well-known college friend of mine, but we won't get into that now. But anyway, so I mean, it's funny that people ask for advice when they're like in college and getting out of college, but really the people who should be asking for advice are currently working games journalists who need a lot of help with their work.
Well, the answer, I mean, the advice is start a YouTube channel. Start yelling. Right. Start but yelling. Like, raise the volume of your voice 200 or 300%.
I think the YouTube landscape will be so much different in a few years. Here's the thing. I might be cynical and skeptical and yada, 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 but I think that people will always be reading and people will always be interested in the written word, no matter where it is. So learning how to read and how to write really, really well, learning how to master the rhythm of sentence structure and be able to write something that makes people want to read every single sentence, and learning proper grammar and learning how to hook people right away at the beginning of a story and keep them engaged on this roller coaster of ups and downs, and learning how to interview people and talk to people and filter that into a compelling story, figure out what they said that's really interesting, figure out what an interesting story really is. These are all skills that will be helpful to everyone no matter what.
Right.
So if you are just starting in college and you think to yourself, how can I learn to hone those skills? That will serve you very well, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I think my only other piece of advice is to be well-rounded and have other interests, like try to develop passions outside of, you know, like when I hear people say, I really want to be a games journalist, if they're young, you know, they're like 19 or 20 years old. I just think that's great. Like, the best thing you can do, at least for a person like me looking at your work, is come in saying, you know, you just have a huge level of expertise in some other thing, or you've done, you know, you have a lot of passions that aren't video games that you follow that then inform how you sort of cover and talk about games. I think that's actually a very, very important thing. And that it isn't just like, okay, well, I've only done video games my whole life. Because there's a ton of people like that. And it's just a good way to stand apart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the other thing is to specialize. And that's kind of the opposite of what you just said. But it's possible to be both well-rounded.
Well, yeah, I mean, sort of, but right. But I see what you're saying. But, they're not mutually exclusive or anything.
Exactly, exactly. So you can be well-rounded and also be like, I'm going to be the best Dota 2 reporter there is, or I'm going to be the best at getting scoops, getting rumors, or I'm going to be the best at investigative reporting, or whatever it is. If you have that specialty rather than going to people, and like the biggest mistake all these young aspiring games journalists make is saying, I'm going to go to IGN, I'm going to go to Kotaku, and I'm going to say, I want to review games. Give me one of your – can I review one of the games that nobody else wants to review? And, like, that's not going to make you stand out. What's going to make you stand out is if you come to me or Kirk or Steven or someone at the site and you say, hey, I have this killer idea about this Dota player this Dota 2 player who's doing drugs and playing the game and he hasn't been caught yet, and I have the scoop because I can interview him because I – have access to him. And if you pitch us on something like that, we'd be like, holy shit, of course we want your story. We want to talk to you. We want to hear more from you.
It's funny how we've talked about this with pitches sometimes, how the difference between the good pitch is the one that actually has the piece of information in it, where it's like, I know, like, this dude did this, or this person said this, and here's the quote, and I want to write a story about that. And then there are pitches that are so similar where they say, here's a story, but I don't actually have any like facts yet, but the story sounds really interesting, right? And like the difference between those two is very night and day for editors, because the one tells you, okay, this person has, they've already got something and they're going to build on that. And the other one says they've got an idea, but they don't actually, they're going to go ask questions about it and maybe just get a bunch of nonsense. So it's very like those two things are different, but it's very
hard.
True.
I mean, it's a catch 22 because it's hard to have that thing when you don't have the platform yet. So you can't say, like, I'm an interviewer for Kotaku, can I talk to you, if you're just starting out and you're a freelancer and you want to pitch it to Kotaku. So it's like that chicken and egg problem. So, yeah, it's tough. Hopefully that was helpful advice for aspiring writers out there. So, Kirk, do you want to talk about how – have we talked about how – I think we talked about how we got into Kotaku, right, in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, the brief version is, like I said, I was a saxophonist, a jazz educator for a while out of school, lived in San Francisco, sort of discovered gaming blogs that I thought were really cool, like Michael Abbott's blog and Lee Alexander's blog, Chris Dahlin, and some other people who, you know, now are very established. And
The Brainysphere.
At the time, it was called the Brainysphere, and I thought, oh my gosh, like, this is how I've always sort of thought of video games, and I didn't know this level of, you know, criticism was going on. And I just got really into that. Started a gaming blog with some friends. you know, it's sort of one thing. It moved really quickly. I think I sort of realized early on that I could be good at it, and that I could hang with people who were doing it. And yeah, I wound up getting some freelance gigs, and that led to a sort of very low paid paced games editing gig, which then mm-hmm. very quickly led to Kotaku column, and then joining Kotaku sort of happened very fast for me. Transition from jazz musician to games journalist happened in like a year or something like that, very fast.
Yeah, it seems like it's the type of thing where it just kind of it's a different path for everyone. Mm-hmm. Some people work at it for years and years and then get their lucky shot. Other people just happen to fall into a job mm-hmm. like this. It really depends. It's a dismal landscape, so don't expect to be hired right away, and don't expect to find a full-time job, because there are a lot of people wanting full-time jobs and not a lot of jobs available. I guess doing your own thing might be good advice.
I always give that advice to people, to start your own. Like, I started my own site, and I even ran like some of my friends as writers under me. And I think that was both good practice, and it demonstrated to anybody who might think about hiring me. Like, if I look now at a person and I see they did something like that, they're running mm-hmm. their own blog on their own, editing and running a show, I think, oh, okay, like, this is impressive. This person.
Yeah, even if no one's reading it.
Yeah, I still think, oh, this looks nice. The writing is good. This is clearly a well-run thing. And that impresses me a lot with a person, because it shows, you know, it demonstrates a lot of the skills that you actually need to do the job.
Yeah. But, I don't know. I get depressed when I think about games journalism and the future of media. But I don't know. We'll keep doing our thing and trying to do the best that we can.
We're just going to be working for Amazon, selling Amazon commerce goods. Links as much as possible. That's just media.
We're going to wind up working for Facebook. Like, we're all just going to
just
be
everybody
Facebook
works
employees.
For Facebook.
Yeah,
yeah, that could
be. We already kind of do, but Facebook doesn't pay. Everyone works for Facebook for free.
Yeah, it is very easy, I think, to get extremely grim about media. But like you said, right, we'll keep doing that. I mean, so far, we still get to do whatever we want and write whatever we want.
That's true.
It's pretty nice. So hopefully that'll just hold out for, I don't know, a little while longer.
I will say that it's easy to stand out in games media, because the general tenor of games media is a lot of people who are just like interested in doing certain types of things, like certain mm-hmm. types of reviews and certain types of features. So if you could come in, and this is like the type of stuff that we do at Kotaku, if you can come in and do something that nobody else is doing, whether it's investigative reporting or really smart reviewing in a really interesting, unique way, like your review of L.A. Noire always comes to mind as like this mm-hmm. really weird, unique thing that you wrote for Killscreen, was it, right?
Yeah, way back in the day.
So if someone comes and really stands out to us in that way, that's a big benefit, I think, mm-hmm. because it's mm-hmm. so hard to do that. And if you write a review and send it to us and you're like, here, the gameplay is like this and the music is like this and the fun factor is like this.
Right.
We're going to be like, why should I care about you when this is the same as everything else I can read on the mm-hmm. internet? Mm-hmm. Stand out. That's the best advice. That's really, the best advice you can give in any field is to stand out. All right, so that about does it for today's episode of Kotaku Split Screen.
I think so.
As a reminder, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, leave us a nice review. Someone asked us a few weeks ago how to support us, because we don't have ads or anything like that. The best way to support us is to listen to our shows, subscribe to us, and keep listening. B, send it to all your friends and tell your friends to subscribe, because they will love this podcast. And C, leave us a nice review on iTunes, because that helps bump us up through the charts.
You can also send us nice emails that emotionally supports us.
We always appreciate those. Yes.
But yes, those are the easiest three ways, I think.
Maybe one day in the future we will have ads on the show, but not today. Mm-hmm. Some people have been trying to get us to sponsor.
It could happen one day.
One day. Most podcasts have
We'll have the middle section where we take a break and we talk about whoever's sponsoring our program.
Yeah. But then it's always the same companies that you hear.
It's this podcast, Squarespace and MeUndies.
Exactly. Those are the big ones.
So one day we'll work
we
that out,
get them
but not this day.
To hook us up. I guess we just gave them free advertisements right there.
I guess.
And what else? You can email us at splitscreen@kotaku.com. Mm-hmm. Find us on Kotaku, Twitter, etc., etc. March is going to be very exciting for the show. We have a lot of cool stuff coming up this coming month. So stay tuned. And thank you for listening.
Mm-hmm. Bye, everybody.
Goodbye.